From Melbourne, it takes about 3 days of solid driving to get to the Nullarbor. And for those first 3 days, there's, like, stuff to look at, yeah? There's the Great Ocean Road, Adelaide, things like that.
You're listening to All the Best, FBI Radio's weekly documentary and storytelling show. I'm Jess Hamilton. On the highway down to Alice Springs, there are very few places to stop and refuel. A couple of small towns, a few roadhouses. Most of them serve as passing tourists, providing petrol and water to travellers heading towards Uluru. And to someone not from around there, each stop can be hard to distinguish from the last. But then you have Wycliffe Well.
My name is Karthik. I'm the manager of Wycliffe Well Holiday Park in Northern Territory. I was working here from last 1 year. It's the middle of nowhere, right? So I love to work here. Not a busy and nowhere to go.
Wycliffe Well is the UFO sighting capital of Australia. The self-proclaimed UFO sighting capital of Australia.
Aliens, like the owner who built this roadhouse like 20 years ago, so he saw like a lot of sightings, the alien sightings around here, or some strange going around here, and the people who used to work here, they seen like a lot of sightings around the roadhouse and this holiday park, and people who used to stay in the caravan park.
It's about 5 hours north of Alice Springs. Karthik runs the town's caravan holiday park, which is one of about three businesses in town. Wycliffe Well is very small, barely more than a few single-storey buildings on the side of the highway. And painted all over those buildings are huge pictures of aliens, UFOs and galaxies. In the roadhouse, wall to wall, are thousands of alien-themed souvenirs, like masks, drink bottles, T-shirts.
Stubby coolers, number plates, alien dolls. Oh, they've loved this. Everyone will stop here and they pull up and everyone will buy one souvenir from here.
There's even a creepy glass casket on the floor with an alien statue lying inside like an Egyptian mummy. And on the dirt driveway out the front, a giant replica of a UFO stands beside some lanky green alien statues. It seems hilariously arbitrary that this town in the middle of the desert has decided to become the UFO capital of Australia. But it works. People come from all over the country and the world hoping to catch a glimpse of a strange light on the horizon or a flicker in the night sky.
People see the sightings, but not very often. Like last couple of days ago, a customer was traveling from Tennant Creek to Wycliffe Well, like towards south, and he pulled up and he's saying, I saw a strange light going on just 5 kilometers away from Wycliffe Well in the sky, like some strange lights, I think it's a UFO. I said, why don't be a UFO?
Never mind that local astronomers reckon the sightings are mostly planes and drones or simply weather events. The locals here believe, even if it's just for the tourists. But despite living in Wycliffe Well for over a year now, Karthik claims he has never seen an alien or a UFO. In fact, according to the incredibly reputable NT newspaper, sightings have been down regionally for about 12 months.
Hopefully I'll see one day. When I see, I'll definitely give you a call and let you know.
Everything in the desert can kind of feel the same after a while, and Wycliffe Well has decided to be different. But what will happen if the UFO sightings dry up? Maybe without the UFOs, Wycliffe Well is nothing more than a surprise novelty stop along the way to a huge, terrifyingly wide open space in the centre of Australia. Desert from horizon to horizon. This week, All the Best is hanging out in the desert. Later on the show, we have a story about three teenagers dodging emus across the Nullarbor. But our first story begins elsewhere in South Australia. Ali's a poet. You may have heard of her because she's been the subject on everyone's lips recently. She writes a lot from her caravan. In the 60s, Ali was born as Penelope Cobby to Audrey Cobby, a young Kanjara woman. But she was tricked away from her mother as a baby and adopted into the Eckerman family. So she grew up on a farm in the mid-north of South Australia. Jump to this year, February 2017, to Ali on the phone in her caravan. On the other end of the line is a panel of judges having a celebratory dinner and congratulating her. They tell her she's just won Yale University's prestigious Wyndham Campbell Literature Prize. The prize is $165,000. And Ali didn't even know she'd been entered into the award. Joe Koning brings us this story.
So it's taking a little bit of time to unravel from the fuss. I'm not really good with fuss. And the caravan provides a good place to hide. The life that I was living the day when the award, you know, around the time when the award was announced, was a content life.
I'm sitting on the edge of Sydney Harbour with Ali Cobby-Eckerman. We are on Gadigal land. It is a noisy, sunny day. Boats drift past behind us. Hulls rub against the pier. Trains are sliding over the harbour bridge in the distance. The people around us are drinking coffee and enjoying the sunshine. It's been 3 months since Ali won the award for her poetry.
I think it's terrific. First, I was a bit horrified. And then I've heard that every unemployed Indigenous poet around the world has gone, yay, we won a prize. So that's been wonderful feedback. I remember the day that I found out about the award, and I checked my pockets and my bank account. I did have $47. Yeah, I was between jobs at the time, writing and living in a caravan, which I was very proud that I'd saved the money and bought a little caravan. I hope that readers see it just as a silly fact and not as a minimisation of the quality of life. You know, I could have been living in a sky-rise building with a lounge that cost $5,000 and been unhappy. The caravan is the perfect place where I can just close myself in. It's in a suburb in Adelaide, at a friend's place, close to the Torrens River. There's lots of birds. I've got my office set up there. It's very, very humble. New bookshelves, got my books up now. And I don't know, it's just my little safety place I like closing the door and, yeah, it's just mine. I think when you've lived a lot of your life not feeling safe in Australia, that the caravan is significant, that I've just got this little patch and that's mine and everyone respects it.
Ali is a member of the Stolen Generation. She was adopted at a young age and grew up on a farm near Adelaide. She's always been a big reader.
As a child, I always loved words and I always loved reading. Oh my gosh, I was just such a little bookworm. Between chores on a farm, growing up on a farm, we were really busy kids. Chooks and cows and lots of jobs. And reading, I guess, was a bit of a break from that. But I was really thirsty to learn about other people in the world and nature. And I used to read encyclopedias, children's stories from the Bible. I think I loved epic dramas, people that had survived bear attacks and, you know, epic stuff. And then school sort of knocked that out of me. I became very insecure and unhappy during my high school years. Growing up adopted, I loved my adopted family. But the society that we lived in taught me at a young age that I was always an other, and often I was a second-class citizen, and that life maybe wouldn't always treat me fairly because of the colour of my skin. And so I ran away to the desert. I was 17 when I ran. And there was a feeling out there that I got that I couldn't understand. I just loved it. I call the desert my home. So when I look at the desert, the red sand country, I see a safetiness, I see a peace, and I see love. I believe the desert is one of the best universities in life, in the world. There's a lot of learning to be done in that big, wide space, and it keeps you humble, and it teaches you how to observe the world in a more truthful manner. Well, at least that's been the effect on me.
Some years after escaping into the desert, Ali found out about her heritage.
I heard stories where old Aboriginal people had gathered at Aldea, this place out on the Nullarbor Plains, and I spent a lot of time there, could find remnants of their existence. Sometimes the mob used to come up from Yalata and sit there waiting for the train for business or funerals, and I used to go and sit with them. They were always very kind to me. I don't know, it was a really nice feeling. And I felt safer out in the desert than I was feeling in rural and urban Australia.
She found out her mother was Audrey Cobby, a young Kanjara woman.
So it was many years later that I met my mum. She told me that she was born at Aldea, that the mob from Yalata was my family. No wonder they were so nice to me. They could probably see my face and recognise who I was. I was the ignorant one. They weren't. So, yeah, the desert does appear a lot in my poetry because it's out there, sitting on traditional land. And I spent a long time sitting down with elders and old people before they passed away, learning about culture. Probably more importantly, learning about myself, learning how to climb my way out of all the hurt and trauma and injustice that was blocking me as a person. So all my adult education has been at Aboriginal education centres. There's something really wonderful about learning with your mob. You create your own safety net. You can share emotions because everyone in the room will understand about trauma. And the humour, the survival humour of Aboriginal people is so wonderful. I think in that environment, I could start being honest or having a more honest understanding of how I'd been feeling for a really long time. Every conversation I was learning. Every conversation I was growing. Every conversation and experience I was enjoying. And that was starting to shape my writing too. I'd been writing poems around the campfire just for fun and just to bring a skill that I had to the campfire, because culturally I was a little girl. We used to write fun poems. And then...
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Brough and I have called this news conference to...
The intervention arrived.
...what we can only describe as a national emergency in relation to the abuse of children in Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory.
And I was watching the traditional owners and traditional people out on country being treated really unfairly, being all labelled in a box. Their individual status being robbed of them, and the few rights that they had being torn away. And I knew it was like for a bigger reason, not about the people, but about the land, the theft of land. And then Mob said, "Ali, can you start writing for us?" Because they were losing their voice. And they knew that I had another stream of voice. And so that was the moment when it became more serious and beyond myself. Here in Australia, it's a passive genocide, the removal of children, the breaking up of families all the time, the incarceration of our men and now our women, the refusal to invest in our healing, when I think we've been asking for healing for a really long time, but we want to own that and do it within our cultural boundaries. And I'm a great example of that, because that's what the old people did for me and gave me a quality of life that nothing else in the world could give me. That's what I want for my peers and our children and our grandchildren and our future. One day I hope we'll have a government that can actually sit down and listen to that and work with us to reduce the trauma that's becoming generational. So now, I mean, with the Wyndham Campbell, I've been saying that it was never a solo career or a single voice, and that's what I'm referring to, that it became a collective need for a voice to get out to report what was actually happening in Central Australia. Black deaths in custody. Despite the cost, a new jail has been built. It seems the incarceration rates are trebling. I only came here in the role of a deaths in custody inspector. All the cells are stark and spotless. Blank screens watch from the corner. The officers have the highest technology. The faces of the staff all look the same. When I walk down this wing and peer into this filthy room, the door closes behind me. The feeling in my heart is changing from a proud strength of duty to fear. All the stories I have ever heard stand silent in the space beside me. A coil of rope is being pushed under the door of this cell. I think we're often reported and seen as victims. Australia needs to grow up and see our strength and how much we've survived.
That story was made by Joe Koning, with thanks to Ali Cobby-Eckerman and help from supervising producer Selena Shannon. Check out Ali's poetry collections like Little Bit, Long Time and Inside My Mother, and her memoir Too Afraid to Cry. Her work puts words to the dispossession and generational trauma faced by Indigenous Australians and her own journey to find her birth mother. You're listening to All the Best. This week we're taking you into the Australian desert. We're going to travel south, where three 19-year-old girls jump in a tiny car and drive long ways across the country. What could possibly go wrong? Emus, that's what. By the way, this story has a language warning.
So, the summer after my first year of university, my friend Sarah Jane decides she wants to drive home for the summer. We're at university in Melbourne, but Sarah Jane is from Perth, and she asks me and another friend, Sam, to drive home with her. Three 19-year-old girls driving long ways across Australia through the Nullarbor Desert. Now, the Nullarbor is, it's just not much to look at, okay? Just flat brown dirt and half-metre-high shrubs stretching out in all directions, horizon to horizon. And here is my one Nullarbor fact that I retained from that trip. The shrubs are what give the Nullarbor its name. Contrary to popular belief, Nullarbor is not an Aboriginal word. It doesn't mean perversely hot place or killer of stupid white men, although both would be accurate. Nullarbor is Latin, nul arbor. It means no trees. Which is stupid, because no trees is not going to distinguish the Nullarbor from every other desert on Earth. The real name for the Nullarbor should be whatever the Latin is for miles and miles of fucking shrubs. From Melbourne, it takes about 3 days of solid driving to get to the Nullarbor. And for those first 3 days, there's, like, stuff to look at, yeah? There's the Great Ocean Road, Adelaide, things like that. But once you get into the desert proper, there's really not much to see. And anything that is not a shrub stands out for miles. On a second day of desert driving, a cluster of non-shrub blips appear on the horizon. And we watch them carefully for about an hour as they get closer. The cluster turns out to be on the border between South Australia and Western Australia. And the blips are, in order, number one, a roadhouse selling petrol, beer and steak sandwiches, in that order. Number two, a giant plastic kangaroo, probably about 20 foot tall and grinning. And number three, a toll booth type archway over the road with a border guard sitting inside. Now, I say border guard, he isn't really a border guard since he isn't really guarding anything. We aren't road tripping into East Germany here. The not really a border guard, for brevity's sake, let's call him a border dude, is really just there to make sure that people are travelling okay and that they aren't about to get stranded in the middle of nowhere without the correct provisions. He takes one look at the three of us, still giggling over the fact that the kangaroo statue doesn't have genitals, and takes a deep breath. The border dude checks that we have water and enough petrol, and we do. He observes that our vehicle doesn't have a bull bar, which is true. Not only do we not have a bull bar, we're basically driving a baked bean tin. Right, well, given that you haven't got a bull bar, you're going to need to be particularly careful not to drive at dusk, he says. We know this. Of course, we're not stupid. Dusk is when the most animals are out, yeah? So running into a kangaroo at full speed would totally total our baked bean tin. Now, at this time of year, said the border dude, it's not the kangaroos you need to worry about. It's the emus. It's December, which is apparently emu hatching season. At this moment, all across the Nullarbor, there are hundreds of daddy emus wandering around with three or four emu chicks trailing after them. Now, if you run into a full-grown daddy emu, you'll ride off your vehicle, no worries. But an even worse thing to do is to separate the daddy emu from any of them baby emus. If you do that, then the daddy emu who can run over 100 kilometres an hour chase you down the road and try to kill your car. The three of us stare at him, open-mouthed. The border dude just nods sagely and then motions for us to drive through. Cut to 3 hours later, and I don't want to say it was dusk, but look, it wasn't noon, is what I'm saying. We're still driving along, and what should we see on the road in front of us but a daddy emu and three little baby emus? Mindful of the border dude's warning, we immediately come to a complete stop right in the middle of the road. Emu chicks are extraordinarily cute, so we're cooing over them and taking pictures while making absolutely sure that we don't make any threatening moves towards the daddy emu at all. The emu family makes its way to the other side of the road, and once they're all safely among the shrubs, we drive on. I'm sitting in the back seat, and as we drive past, still waving and cooing, I casually glance out the left side window and see one little emu chick, all alone, on the side of the road. I scream, "Oh my God, there's another baby emu, go, go, go," which comes out sounding like, "Oh, it's my mother," because I'm a little overexcited. Sam, who's driving, slams her foot down and we hootle off, all of us, Sam included, craning our necks around to see what Daddy Emu will do. Will he start running immediately? Will take a moment to paw the ground like a charging bull? Will he let out a raging squawk of defiance? Will his nostrils flare? Do emus have nostrils? We wait with bated breath. Now, what I remember happening next, in hindsight, seems unlikely, but I swear to God, this is what I remember. As our car streaks away, I watch the daddy emu cock his head to one side, wrinkle his brow, and squawk, "Hey, what's the hurry? You guys got a hot date?" Maybe it didn't happen exactly like that, but I swear to God, there was something in the animal's body language, even as it rapidly shrunk in the rearview mirror, that managed to concretely convey the emu's absolute disinterest in menacing us, pursuing us, paying us any attention at all in any way, shape or form. Perhaps this was a very chilled out daddy emu. Perhaps the fourth emu chick wasn't even his, just one he was babysitting for a mate. Or perhaps, and this is by far the most likely scenario, perhaps it gets very boring sitting all day in a not really a guard booth in the middle of nowhere. And under those circumstances, three 19-year-olds in a tiny car represent an entertainment opportunity that must not go to waste.
That story was by Mae Jasper, who recently won the first ever Moth Grand Slam in Melbourne. Editing was by Beck Fari. If you like Mae Jasper's style, you can catch her on her own podcast, Random Article. Each episode, she presses the Random Article button on Wikipedia, and no matter what comes up, she dives deep into it and quickly becomes obsessed with the tiniest, most specific and fascinating topics in Wikiland. You can find the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or other podcatchers of your choice. Or go to the website randomarticle.net. Thank you to the contributors who worked on this week's stories. And if you want to make something for All the Best, we'd love to hear from you. To get involved, just email us at ep@allthebestradio.com. We take story pitches from new and emerging radio makers from all around Australia, and it's okay if you haven't made stories for radio before. We can help with that and give training and support. So just get in touch and we'll take it from there. That's ep@allthebestradio.com. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager. Tegan Nichols compiles our show and I'm Jess Hamilton. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're at it, subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app and leave us a review.